Welcome to Where Policy Meets Politics with Dr. Alvita King and Emmanuel Boone.
Hallelujah.
Hey, Emmanuel, Mama King, loving to get this information out to our listeners.
I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream. Still have a dream.
Hello, I'm Evangelist Alvita King. Welcome to CYC Broadcast, or Changing Your Community Broadcast. Our producer, Jerry Van, works very hard along with our team to bring you up-to-date news that you will not hear in fake news. This is real news, real time.
Well, we're back here on Changing Community Broadcast, where we ask not what our community can do for us, but what can we do for our community to make a better place. With Adam Cochran, the president of Safe Kids and founder of Hero Program. Adam, how are you today?
Doing well, sir. How are you?
Great. So excited about having you back on. Sort of a sad time in our nation. One of the key things to making our community better is to make it safe. And, you know, so many questions have been coming through about the 17 children that were massacred at the school. And, you know, I figure you would be the best guest to kind of look at. What should the parents be telling their children about this violent situation?
You know, it's rough. And we look at kids now at a much younger age find out about these things, you know, through their friends, their social media. So we've had kindergartners, first graders come home and say, Mom, Dad, I saw this, trying to make sense of it. And when we talk about talking to kids about violence just in general, wrap it around the story. Let them talk about what they've heard, what they've seen, and express themselves. And explain to your kids, you know, there's people in life who may want to hurt us, and there's people in life that may want to help us. And what types of people are there? What types of people might want to hurt us, and what types of people might want to help us? And it's a way of starting the conversation with your child around what we used to call a stranger danger, and that there's people out there, whether they're other students or other people, that may want to hurt you.
So how do you talk to them about when they, you know, see violence events unfold on television, when they see those children crying, parents, and some of the footage that I've seen on Facebook that's been leaked? I don't know if you've seen some of that footage. I just imagine children stumbling onto that. Seeing someone laying there deceased, blood and all of that. How do you talk to your children about that after they've seen that?
You know, that's a rough question because, again, we try to protect our kids, right? I mean, we want that age of innocence to a degree. But when they see these things, they're going to come asking, what does this mean? Why is that person hurt? Why is this person hurting people? And we can start to liken it, and we even say, connect it to some of the things that they know. Connect it to some things, whether maybe that's happened to them, maybe some of their favorite cartoon characters, some of the things that they read. We can look to literature, and we can look to some of the television shows and some of the cartoons that they watch and start to draw parallels. You know, growing up for me, it was always Bugs Bunny and Roger Rabbit and, you know, Wile E. Coyote and the Fox, and to start to draw some parallels to these types of things at a very, very low level. So in other words, we don't want to panic our kids. We don't want to say everyone's going to be out to hurt us. What we want to do is just have them understand that, you know, sometimes people hurt, and they hurt because of a number of reasons. Sometimes they were hurt. Sometimes they're jealous. Sometimes they're ill and they needed help. And it's a way, and we can almost use it as a learning turning point for our kids.
So what would you tell your children? What could you tell, let's say, middle school, for instance? Is there some type of specialized training that we can give? Well, we can start from kindergarten all the way up to the 12th grade. But is there some type of training that we could give to cut down on the amount of children that are lost during these massacres? Because it seemed like they run in like sort of like a panic mode. So is there anything that we could teach our children before sending them out to school that would probably cut down on those chances if that massacre was to occur tomorrow? What would you tell us?
Right. And the first thing we talk about is listen to your body. Your body's going to do one of a couple of things under this type of stress. You're going to have the fight, flight, or freeze mentality. That's just a natural reaction to your body, and that's that natural life-saving. And what we've done with the HERO program is we've created just an acronym to kind of explain that to kids and how to teach it. So HERO stands for Hide, Escape, Run, and Overcome. And that's one of the things that your body is going to want to seek and do. So depending on what finds you in life, depending on what type of violence finds you, one of those things or a combination of those in any sort of order can help. And so if your child wants to feel like, I don't feel good right here, I need to run, I want to get away, well, then run or escape. That's completely fine. If you're confronted with this person, that person grabs you or they try to hurt you or throw something at you, then overcome. I mean, that's doing whatever you have to, throwing, kicking, yelling, screaming, whatever you can do to get away from this person, deter them from trying to hurt you. Or it might be finding that, as we saw before, hide is kind of like lockdown, to where we can find a nice, safe place, we can barricade ourselves in their really good hiding space until this danger blows over. So there's a few components, but it starts with listening to your body.
In wake of what happened not too long ago with the 17 children, I know we spoke before, and I think I explained, we were talking about it, and me growing up in the inner city, there was police at the school, not only being a former deputy sheriff, we had deputies in elementary school as well. Do you think that America, and what's your opinion on it? I mean, when I first seen it is, you know, a lot of people want to point the finger to Washington, but I think a lot of these things, and you know, I really hold Washington responsible for a lot of things, but my thought is that I think that it could have been prevented if it would have been done on a local level. And what I mean by that is that when I was growing up, the police was at every school. I believe New York school system has a police department. I know Atlanta has one. I know Chicago has police there because of the violence that transpires in the inner city. But my experience, and if you notice, I haven't heard of any, and now correct me if I'm wrong, you hear about killings in the inner city, but you don't hear about anyone actually going into a school and killing up people because, you know, I believe one of the reasons is the police is there. And if you come in and they have metal detectors at these schools, and if they were to show up, and for a short period of time, I did security at school as well, but.
Welcome to Where Policy Meets Politics with Dr. Alvita King and Emmanuel Booz.
Hallelujah.
Hey, Emmanuel, Mama King, loving to get this information out to our listeners.
I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream. Still have a.
Most likely, if the police is there, I can pretty much guarantee that it's going to cut down on the amount of children that would have got shot. So what do you think? Is America ready for that? Do you agree with that? And the reason, the question is, the first question came to me, and I guess it depends on what type of environment that you grew up in. Is America ready for that? That we should put police officers in the schools?
You know, that's a great question. I've been getting that quite a bit. And I think it's different everywhere you go. Now, having a police officer in school helps a lot, but it's not the 100%. We saw in Columbine, there was a school resource officer at Columbine who engaged both of those shooters before they went in. Sometimes you get overwhelmed. Sometimes you're not in the right position. I've heard some early reports that there was a school police or campus public safety that was on that high school campus. I don't think that's been necessarily confirmed yet, but everything is a stage. And you make a very interesting point when you say that the inner city schools, we very rarely see active shooter scenarios. It's very pinpoint violence. It might be gang violence. It might be one-on-one violence. It might just be crimes in general, but we typically don't see active shooters. Where you see those is in sometimes more affluent communities, rural communities, where it's more, I guess, what you would call a traditional school setting. There's not a lot of violence or a lot of crime that's happening on school campus. And one has to wonder, is it because of the types of kids? Meaning that inner city, these kids are scrappy. They know how to fend for themselves. Most of them are probably well-versed in street fighting and in street smarts. So if you're going to go into one of those schools, you're going to get a large opposition coming towards you because you're going to have a bunch of well-seasoned kids who grew up knowing that I have to fight through violence. Versus some of the other schools where, you know, parents have sheltered their kids from things like the HERO program and from other types of violence and of the world to kind of grow up in a nice kind of sphere of bubble. So I would wonder if there's a correlation, but I would venture to imagine, just knowing the psychology of active shooters and predators in general, you look for the easy target. You look for the path of least resistance. Now, if I know I can go to an elementary school or a high school or a middle school where I know they haven't done anything, the most we've done is maybe a lockdown drill, maybe, and you're going to have a bunch of panicked kids, that's a much easier target than a school who such as Using the Hero program, or is inner city, where they're a little bit more scrappy. They're prepared for threats that come in. I think that's a big determining factor. And when we look finally at police on campus, I'm never going to tell you don't have a police officer on campus, but I will tell you that I'm from in California, and parts of California are actually removing their police officers from schools because of the perception that I don't want my kids to be under a law enforcement or a government rule by having a police officer on campus. So they're willing to take their chances based upon the perception of the uniform on campus. So I think everywhere in the country we go, we're seeing different opinions.
You know, it's kind of ironic that you mentioned that we were talking to someone else, and I remember growing up in the inner city there, and the police officers, they had on plain clothes, but they were armed. And, you know, some listeners might notice or not, but I was an athlete in school, me and my brother, and I'll never forget there was a gentleman that had been held back several times, and my brother was making fun of him. And when I was growing up, there were, you know, like you said, growing up in the inner city, I had left a private school to go into the public school, which was was totally different. Okay, first of all, the private school didn't have, it was a different culture. The private school didn't have police or anything in it. The nuns ruled with an iron fist and a ruler across the back of your head and your knuckles. But you know, going into that environment, and we were coming out of wrestling practice, and my brother was making fun of a guy, and I thought they were going to mix it up. The guy pulls out a 45 Magnum and shoots at us. And that was the environment that I grew up in. And so in high school, you know, of course, I ended up going into law enforcement. But, you know, I think of how that those officers, you know, I went back later to see those officers, and they were telling me that that their hands were tied. I graduated high school in 1991. And he said that the way that they ruled that school, we were safe, but they ruled that school kind of like with iron fist, to be honest with you. I don't think that they mistreated us, but if they got wind that something was going to go on, that's why I'm saying probably be better to deal with it on a local level. If they suspected that you wanted to do something or you had a weapon, it was nothing for them to just, and you didn't have to, they would cut your lock off, go through your things. And those guys, and the officers had this thing, and they would tell, this is our school. You're not going to do this. You're not going to do that. And we respected those guys. You know, I sort of think to our young people of today, probably wouldn't put up with everybody's lock because they heard that it was a weapon and everybody's locker got cut open. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
Our parents was okay with it. The principal was okay with it. We did not have a voice in it. And so I'm thinking, you know, when I think about the schools and I think about the security that I did there, and I'll never forget how society had changed. You know, I was working security up at my old school. And they said that my gun was making some people uncomfortable, and they wanted unarmed security there. And my thing was, well, you find somebody else to do it because I know that environment. And the ironic thing that happened, they hired some people in there without firearms, and the kids took over the school.
Welcome to Where Policy Meets Politics, with Dr. Alvita King and Emmanuel Boone.
Hallelujah.
Hey, Emmanuel, Mama King, loving to get this information out to our listeners.
I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream. Still have a.
So my question is: do you think America is ready to have policemen in there? What's your opinion on that? Do you think that that would have turned out differently if you had a police officer at that school?
Well, you know, hindsight being 50-50, maybe. I kind of think we're going to start moving kind of the post, like we did after September 11th. Okay. We had to look real hard at what we were doing after September 11th, and we made a bunch of changes. And I think that we're going to get to the point in some sort of middle ground of schools being a little bit like airports. And when I say that, means that we lose a little bit of our privacy rights. So, you know, your bags get searched at the airport. Well, that's in direct violation of the Fourth Amendment. You have to go through screening. You have to go through a number of things. And I'm not suggesting that we do full TSA screenings and scanning backpacks when you come to the school necessarily. But what I'm saying, like you said, when there's threats, when right now the system failed us in Florida. And you look at how many times the police had gone and contacted him. We knew that he had behavioral problems. All these things we knew. But there was no law, there was nothing that allowed us to take affirmative action towards this. So what can we do other than keeping a strong eye on it? And you can see what a strong eye did. It didn't really help much. And we saw it in Santa Barbara at the Goleta shooting. We've seen it before to where there's been signs, but there's no trigger in the law for us to do something about it as law enforcement. And I think you're going to see potentially the Fourth Amendment potentially relaxed at school, so that way you can go open up lockers and it's legal. You don't have a Fourth Amendment search and seizure issue. I think we may see some changes in the law when it comes to threats, as far as being able to take action on threats or behavior. Because we've gotten really good, again, since 9/11, see something, say something. Fantastic, we did, and what happened? But we weren't able to do anything. We saw something, we said something, but nothing was done. And I think we're going to start to see that change. And if we put police officers on campus, in some areas, we have the money to do that. We have the resources to do that. I know in Southern California, we have Los Angeles Unified School Police, Santa Ana School Police, Fontana School Police, and San Diego and San Bernardino. So you look at all the school districts there across the Southland, and we only have a handful of police departments that are embedded within the schools. We have school resource officers in virtually every city. But again, you have two or three or five officers for eight or nine high schools and the middle schools. We're going to get into a resource problem here, I think, real quickly. And so we got to find the kind of middle ground. How can we be most effective and maybe change some laws and policy using the resources we have?
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, because when I was having this conversation, that you noticed that a lot of times when it comes to budgets, the inner cities don't have as big a budget as some of these other suburban communities, but they find a way to have those officers. A lot of those officers sometimes working part-time or what have you, but they figure out a way. And I think that maybe there's something that can be done on a federal level as far as funding, as far as working with the state and local law enforcement in order to cut down on it. The other thing is you know, I'm thinking with two different caps on and how they would deal with it and how I would deal with it. As soon as someone is potentially known as a threat, usually, and you're securing that place, there's a picture usually you have of this person, right? And so, and you say this person is a threat and they're talking about doing all these things and they're not even allowed on campus. And so I'm just wondering if, you know, not being at those other places, is I'm just wondering how, if a person is known as being a threat, because you know, I usually what happened, you have a picture of them, you don't come back up here, then you place, or you'll be trespassing, you will be arrested on the spot. Okay. And I'm thinking, okay, now we know that this guy is a threat. And he gets in the building. We know it wasn't a resource officer there. And then we look at Columbine or whatever. And we know that this person is a threat. It's just like, look, don't come back up here. We know what you're up to. And I mean, even securing the courthouses as well. There were certain people, I'll never forget, the individual that wanted to kill me and one of the judges. And that was dealt with swiftly. We took those type of threats seriously. So I'm still on the, we might disagree a little bit, which is fine. This is what this is all about, is I'm pro, let's get some officers in there, because the question is asked, well, do we arm the teachers? And the only problem I have with arming the teachers, you brought up a valid point before, is will that teacher be able to shoot another student? It takes a certain type of person, which I understand, to be able to say, okay, it's time to end this threat. So what do you think about, I'm really not for, now the teachers want to go out and get the training, I'm for it, but I'm really thinking that trained professionals is the best way, best determined to stop this. And if you agree with me, say so. If not, tell me why you don't agree with us putting police officers in all of those schools. Because if you think about it, after 9/11, what did we came up with? The air marshals. Now, I don't believe they're on every flight, but America was willing to make that adjustment. You know, you hear people complaining about TSA, but I think it's something that we've learned to live with. And so what do you think is going to happen? Do you think that, because my school, I grew up at, they had metal detectors, and we just dealt with it. What do you think?
You know, more law enforcement is usually a good thing. I'm never going to tell you, no, let's get rid of more cops. I'm always going to tell you, yeah, let's get some more law enforcement, because we're looking at more resources. We're looking at more people to investigate these things. We're looking at more people to be on campus to see things. We're looking at more professionals, like you said, who are trained to where if we see someone who comes and we're like, wait a minute, we've had problems, he's been expelled, we know he's not supposed to be there, let's go have some meaningful conversation with him and see what he's doing here. I think all of that is inclusive. But I look back to, you know, history repeats itself.
Okay.
And the last time we had a fire that killed mass casualties in a school was in the 50s, 1958 in Chicago. And, you know, I have to imagine we're having back then the same conversations we're having now, which is we put a firefighter in every classroom. What do we do about these fires? What do we do about this? And we eventually figured it out. We do fire drills every month. We do fire sprinklers. And we have fire hoses and fire extinguishers and flame retardant things and windows and doors that open. And so we created an infrastructure and training with personnel and resources to do that. And I think this is going to be the same thing. We're going to have to start training and practicing with the kids in a meaningful manner, far, far beyond a lockdown drill. We're going to need to look at the design of these places. Do we need to add things like some companies are doing, the shot detection sensors and or video analytics, so that way the cameras in schools can pick up students who have been expelled or and alert. I mean, we have a ton of technology that can start to help some of these matters. I think it's going to be a little bit of a dynamic if we can get more resources with police officers on campus. It's not a one-size-fits-all model, but I think that having the officers in schools having certain protections in place at both entry and while you're in school is going to become something that we need to accept, and we're going to have to find that acceptable level.
Yes, and I think about them cutting those lockers open, but it was based on some of the things that had happened in that community. And what do you think? Okay, we talk about putting a resource officer in there. What do you think they should do when you talk about a lockdown drill? Do you think it should be uniformly, or I know different places, because there's a new device. I don't know the name of it. You've probably seen it, where the teacher could put it on the door and no one can open that door. Do you think those are effective, and does that need to be in every classroom, or there's not a one-all fit-all?
Well, as we've gone around the country and I've looked at hundreds of classrooms, there's no two that are virtually the same. Every classroom has got something different. In California, Nevada, Arizona, we love these floor-to-ceiling windows that we put all across the wall. So it pretty much creates like a fishbowl effect of the classroom. Great for learning, great natural light. Problem when someone's trying to hurt you. And so that we look at all this design, and it's completely different across the country. And I think, you know, when we talk about practicing, we've done lockdown drills now since Columbine, which is, it almost becomes a joke at the older kids, because they walk over, lock the door, turn off the lights, sit in the middle of the room and really do nothing, which eerily enough we saw happen in Florida. You look at something more progressive, and you know, with the HERO program, we do parts of it. There's different companies out there that do something beyond lockdown, which is, it's not just you flip a siren or you flip a drill or a bell and you do something. It's a curated story. We have to learn from our past. So, you know, we have these active shooter or violent intruder drills at recess, when you're at lunch, when you're in the classroom, when you're out of the classroom. Because as we saw, and as we saw in Texas and we've seen in Kentucky, it finds us not in the classroom. So a lockdown does you no good in an open field. So I think we need to practice and engage a little bit, not only the conversation in the classroom, but we also need to engage our bodies in practicing that just sitting in the middle of the room, waiting for help is not the solution. It hasn't been for a long time.
What is the connection between most of these shootings that you've studied with mental illness?
Virtually every, and I say virtually because nothing's 100%, but when we look at, when we start studying active shooters all the way back, Columbine in 1999 and even before, most are on some sort of illicit drug or prescription medication, whether it be for pain, whether it be for a mental illness, focus, depression. The majority of them are somehow medicated with something. So one can draw the conclusion that it's by and large a mental health problem. And if you think about people willing to hurt other people in masses, if you're of your right mind, I'm not sure anyone who'd want to do that, even when we practice and train. So again, my time in law enforcement, and even as a professional trainer, we will use Nerf guns and other simulations in businesses and in schools for them to practice these things. And even for me, who's now done this hundreds of times, I still have a very awkward feeling walking around an office space trying to shoot people with a Nerf gun. Along with the rest of the staff and the trainers. It's just not a very natural feeling occurrence. So whether it's a true mental illness that they're medicated for, whether it's an illness that's gone undiagnosed, whether it's just extreme amount of depression or anger from being bullied or from being out of the norm, I think you're right when it comes to, if it's mental health driven, that's a huge component because, again, I'm not, and the majority of American citizens don't even like the thought of death, no less going out and killing a bunch of people.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. It's just this, you know, you don't get up, oh, I'm going to, you know, kill a bunch of people. And that makes me go back to the inner city a little bit, that most of the killing that transpires there is they know the person and they're singling the person out. Now, there's occasionally where they'll go and, you know, when rival gangs would used to try to go shoot up whole schools, but then the department came in. And so it's just going to be pretty interesting to see where we're going in America as far as, you know, making our children safe. And it's sort of like 9/11, how in the beginning we were all like, do whatever you have to do. And then we start hearing complaints. I was in the Chicagoland area at that time, and I remember after 9/11, you couldn't take pictures of buildings and things of that nature. And I'll never forget. And I tell this, and it was kind of comical. I'll never forget that after 9/11, I get on the elevator in the in a building in Chicago, and a guy had on, I don't know what his religion was, but he had a long beard and a turban on. When he got on that elevator, I got off. I mean, because of that type of, and everyone was so nervous. I'm like, what the heck? I'm getting out of here. You know, me being African American, everybody else was like, me getting off, I'm getting off. And it wasn't so much that I had a problem with any Arabs or anything, but hey, building just blew up. He gets on here with a box. I was upset. At the time, I wasn't in law enforcement. I was upset with security. He didn't go through the box. And he was talking about, well, the guy would have been offended. I said, wait, I want to be safe. Why didn't you check that box? And he's getting on the elevator with us. And so we, after a great tragedy like this, we're more open to, say, you know, do whatever. Because here's the thing about it. I don't think that we can put a price on human life. I think that even if we have to get money from the state or federal way, that we of America has come up with some way to protect our children. What do you think other alternative is? Do you think that some of the parents could, what could a parent do to kind of make the school more safe? Do you think they have a volunteer program or what?
Yeah, you know, we've seen volunteer programs work well, but, you know, it has to be organized. And like you said, right after these things, there's a surge to find a quick fix. And everyone's talking mental health, they're talking gun laws, or they're talking all kinds of different things. We're looking for that one quick, let's do it now, fix, so it ends. And it's not that simple. And I think if parents get together, and, you know, we've seen the PTAs around forever, or in some places they're called the foundation. And, you know, if you have parents that, and if it's nothing more than a couple parents as greeters in the morning, because you're going to know who all the kids are, you're going to be able to watch for cues in the kids. You know, the story about the elevator is great because, like you said, I was afraid that I was going to offend somebody. And I think we've gotten so far to the point that we don't say anything because we're fearful of being labeled as a racist or as a bully or as, you know, you name it, whatever you want the title or label to be. And I think, you know, if we look overseas and we look at other countries and how they protect their borders and how they protect some of their citizens for both internal and external threats, it's all about behavior. It doesn't matter the color of your skin, how tall you are, short you are, your sex, your race, none of that matters. What matters is the behavior. And if your box is going to get searched, everyone's box is getting searched. There's no different. If you're going to have to walk through a metal detector, everyone's going to have to walk through a metal detector. And I think if we talk about having parents as volunteers and nothing more than they want to volunteer, they get some training in behavioral assessment to know what to look for, to see some signs, and they stand as the greeters every morning. And you know you're going to walk by Mr. Jones and Mrs. Smith, and they're going to greet you, and how do you do, and welcome to school, and how is everyone, and how was your game yesterday, and high-fiving kids. Number one, it's great interaction. But number two, they're going to see the majority of every kid that walks through, and is there a problem? Is one of these kids having an emotional problem? Are they being triggered? Are they in a state of crisis? And maybe we need to pull this kid away and talk to him. Maybe we need to do something more. And I think if we have more eyes open, and like we talked about earlier, changing some policy to where we do have some teeth to do something when kids are exhibiting this behavior, that might be a really easy start and part of a group and a coalition that people are already used to.
Well, you know what? You brought something back to my memory. I remember working as a deputy sheriff in the courts, and a gentleman walked through, and if the metal detector went off, I wasn't going to allow you to come in that building, okay? Mm-hmm. So the gentleman comes in, he had on a turban, and he had on his long robe, and these other guys was with him, and I don't know what his position and religion, but it was pretty high. So when he went, he goes through, the metal detector goes off. And there was another officer with me. He's like, man, if you, you know, he's going to say something. If I say, no, you're going back through that metal detector. And they got so upset. So one guy, I said, wait a minute, you're going back through. So then I find out that one guy had a holster on him, but he didn't have a weapon. Okay, you're going back through. So the guy with the turban on, he kept coming through. I said, well, he said, well, I'm going to be late for court. I said, well, hey, you're not getting in here. So then he went back out, and they were just so offensive. And then you could see someone in the alliance like, why are you doing it to him? You must be. And the other officer, you know, shook his head and walked away because he knew it was going to be a problem. But here's what happened. I made him, I said, well, we got to find out what it was. After searching him thoroughly, he had a knife tied around his neck hanging up under that robe. Now, most people that seen me doing that, because we're, like you said, so afraid that we're going to offend someone, would have said, you know what, just let him go on through. And then he explained to me, it's part of his religion to have a knife hanging around his neck. I said, well, you're not getting in here. Pull it off. So he took it off. And so I think one of the things we have to be aware of is that we can't worry about offending people. Because I could just imagine the damage he would have been able. First of all, I don't know why he was trying to bring that knife in there. That's the first thing. The second thing, what if he would have took it out and just started stabbing people in the courthouse, and me saying, well, I'm going to be politically correct, so I'm not going to say anything to him. And I think that's very important. I'm just going to be pretty interested to see how we deal with this with the proper balance in America. What do you think?
You know, you bring up a great point. And when we talked earlier, you know, you asked, what is the price of life? And if the price of life ends up being offending somebody or not, is that a price we're willing to pay? You know, to your point, it gets beyond color, it gets beyond religion, it gets beyond intent. What do you have? Here are the rules. These are the rules that we've laid out for our campus. These are the rules we've laid out for our courthouse. And it doesn't matter who you are. You don't get through with X, Y, and Z. That's just the way it is. If you display or exhibit these signs or behaviors, we know from science that that's an indicator. So you're not getting through. And I think if we get away from some of the me mentality and more to an us mentality, you know, are we going to sacrifice the safety of the many for the, you know, for the few being upset or the few being unhappy that they believe they're being targeted? I think if we set the ground rules, we set the policies right, we can start to identify these things. We can start to look at, okay, what do we need to do? What needs to change? What is it that is offending people, and why is it offending people? And better yet, should they be offended? Should you be offended if it says no weapons in the front of the courthouse, and you walk through and you say, well, this is my religious token. This is something that's very cultural. That might be, but you got to leave it in the car for the time that you're in the courthouse, or you need to leave it at home for the time that you're in school. I think we need to start to evaluate, where are we setting our boundaries? What exceptions are we making? And are those exceptions potentially causing lives?
Well, you know what? I think that when you think about, getting back to the officers being in school, and when you think about the benefit of community policing, I remember a lot of things that could have transpired in high school didn't transpire because the officers there, they had such a relationship with the students that a lot of times the students would say, so-and-so are planning on fighting down here, or so-and-so has a weapon in the car. And it was sort of like, if you told them something, it wouldn't come pointed back at you. And I'll never, you jog my memory a little bit, and I'll never forget that this guy had a sawed-off shotgun in his trunk, and someone was saying it. And the officers back then, you know what they did? They took him outside. You opening this trunk right now. This is going to be a problem. And, you know, he didn't want to do it. And, well, they convinced him he was going to, and they pulled those weapons out of that car. Now, the question is, a lot of people are like, well, did he have a right to do it? Well, I'm glad he did it, you know, because he had ill intent, sawed-off shotgun in the trunk of a car, and he getting into it with these guys. And what happened was, I'll never forget, the officer said, no, you're going to open it up. And it was something about having him. And that's why I'm probably a proponent for it, because I remember seeing them. And it was sort of like everybody, they knew who the troublemakers were, who weren't supposed to be up there. A lot of times they knew about the fights before they weren't going to happen. And then I remember them just telling guys that they knew were going to cause problems. Look, we're not going to have you back up here. We're not going to have a problem out of you. And to be honest with you, there was a certain level of fear and respect of those officers those students had not to come around there doing those things. And so I think that we're all of a product of our environment. And, you know, with seeing that shooting, I'm like, you know what? Spend the money, get those guys in there. But, you know, after talking to those guys years later, after I became a deputy sheriff, and they told me that the things that they did when I was in school, I graduated in 1991, they said there's nowhere in the world that they could do it because of, you know, I guess it was the PTA and the school board told them that they shouldn't be doing that. But I don't think that they understood the effect that these guys really had. And I could tell this. I was a practical joker and an athlete, and we had these little things called stink bombs. And I was a stink bomb bandit. I mean, this went on for months. And I'll never get the principal would come up, and he's like, we're going to catch whoever doing this. And I would look at the principal and say, hey, yeah, they'd catch him. And another one would go off. But I remember the day that the principal got fed up, and a friend of mine, a guy I played football with, and my sister got caught. They put so much pressure on them that they told on me. And I'll never forget, you would have had thought that I was a Unabomber. Those officers came to the classroom, and they said, get them. And I was like, what did I do? And I mean, they were kind of rough. One of them pushed me and hit me and said, push me, go on. You know what you did. And I got into that principal's office, and it was a major ordeal. And that's how tight they had that school. That type of, you know, that practical joke and stuff, I think it was harmless, but the principal and those guys took it seriously. But yeah. I remember how much effect that the principal, you had the principal, you had the community, you had the law enforcement, the parents, law enforcement, and the principal were all on one side. You're going to get safe, and you're going to be able to do your schoolwork. And so they was able to come together and create that environment on how they found out who I was relatively quickly. Setting off stink bombs. And so I think that as we have more of these dialogues and more organizations like yourself, I think that we'll start seeing the schools a lot more safer than they are. And it's tragic what happened. In closing, is there any advice you would give to a principal? Because we had quite a bit of principals listening to us, that you would give the principals and give us some information, more information, how they can contact your organization.
You bet. You know, as a principal, everyone's looking to you. You know, your staff, your faculty, the students, everyone looks to the principal. I mean, the principal is the figurehead of any school. And so there's a lot of questions coming your way. And to be confident, you know, to do your research, to do what you know is right as a leader, both in education and in the community. And, you know, all that we do is available online. It's safekidsinc.com. All of our social media is at safekidsinc. We have educator resources. We have family resources to start the conversations with kids, to start the conversations around, and then obviously information about obtaining the program and for use in schools. But it's a program and a situation we're all going to have to solve together. There, like we said, there's no magical cure to what's going on here. It's going to take people going beyond the norms, changing some of the normal, changing the way that we think, and really, like we said, we can hope and we can pray, and our thoughts can be with them. But it only goes so far for so long. And now it's, you know, we see people willing to take action. Let's take some actions right now, today. What can we do today? And we can start the conversation. We can start to address and get different programs in the schools. We can start this today without any legislation. So to all those educators out there, you truly are our heroes. You're going to be the ones on the front lines. When something happens, you're the ones who are going to be making decisions. So you truly have our hearts, and you are our heroes.
Well, I tell you what, your information will be also on our website, and it'll be up there where they can get in contact with you. You know, we'll be proactive, and hopefully a lot of these tips will be utilized, and we'll save some lives based on the information you gave us today. Look forward to having you back. Hopefully have you back on a more happier note. It's always tragic when we lose those young lives, but hopefully this show helped a lot of people figure out how to make their schools more safe, and then they can go get those resources. Thank you so much.
Welcome to Where Policy Meets Politics with Dr. Alvita King and Emmanuel Booz.
Hallelujah.
Hey, Emmanuel. Mama King, loving to get this information out to our listeners.
I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream. Still have a